This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. We know Amy Poehler for the many characters she played on Saturday Night Live, including co-anchor of Weekend Update, for her starring role on the NBC comedy Parks and Recreation as a dedicated public servant in the Pawnee Parks and Rec Department, and for co-hosting the Golden Globes with Tina Fey. Poehler takes off the wigs and the costumes and steps out of character in her new memoir, Yes, Please. Poehler is about to start a new era of her life because the seventh and final season of Parks and Recreation will be airing next year. She spoke with Terry last Tuesday.
Amy Poehler, welcome back to Fresh Air and congratulations on the book. And I'd like you to start with a reading from the book. How about from the very beginning?
Okay, thanks, Terry. This is the preface, and it's called Writing is Hard. I like hard work, and I don't like pretending things are perfect. I've learned that about myself. And I don't have any fear of writing. I've been writing my whole life, stories and plays and sketches and scripts and poems and jokes. Most feel alive and fluid, breathing organisms made better by the people who come into contact with them. But this book has nearly killed me. Because, you see, a book has a cover. They call it a jacket, and that jacket keeps the inside warm so that the words stay permanent and everyone can read your genius thoughts over and over again for years to come. Once a book is published, it can't be changed, which is a stressful proposition for this improviser who relies on her charm. I've been told that I am better in the room and prettier in person. Both of these things are not helpful when writing a book. I'm looking forward to a lively book-on-tape session with the hope that Kathleen Turner agrees to play me when I talk about some of my darker periods. One can dream. It's clear to me now that I had no business agreeing to write this book. I have a job that keeps me shooting 12 hours a day, plus two children under six. I'm going through a divorce and producing many projects and falling in love and trying to make appointments for cranial massage. All of these things are equally wonderful and horrible and keep me just off balance and busy enough to make spending hours alone writing seem like a terrible idea. Plus, I'm 42, which is smack dab in the middle. I haven't lived a full enough life to look back on, but I'm too old to get by on being pithy and cute. I know enough now to know I know nothing. I'm slugging away every day, just like you. But nonetheless, here we are. I've written a book. You have it.
Thanks for reading that. That's Amy Poehler reading from her new memoir, Yes, Please. So who convinced you to write a book, and are you still talking to them?
I know. I used to send emails to my editors with headlines like, why are you doing this to me? This will never work. I will never finish. I hate you guys. I agreed to it because, like most things, and in many ways why I titled the book Yes, Please, I try to say yes to opportunities. So I said yes to one, even though I didn't quite feel ready. And then I just said yes first and then did the work after.
In the book, you have reproductions of an old report card, old photos of you from the 80s with Melanie Griffith working girl hair and big shoulder pads. You devote a chapter of your book to the demon voice in your head and a lot of people's heads that says, I hate how I look. Do you still have that voice?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, every day. In the book I write about growing up, the demon voice was around, but it didn't really live in my room. And then when I started liking boys, it moved into the top bunk and stayed there for a while. And I think as a woman and a man, you fight against that voice and you have to find a way to live with it because it will not go away. It just, you can kind of relegate it to the back shelf, you know, near your field hockey equipment and hope it just stays quiet. But every once in a while it does come out and it comes out at strange times. You know, it doesn't matter really about success or being in a magazine or, you know, it just kind of pokes its head out every once in a while to remind me that, you know, you're ugly or you're not as pretty as this person or you're whatever the, you know, mean thing it likes to say. And I feel like you have to kind of learn to treat it, or I've worked on for many years, treating it like it's just like an annoying relative that doesn't quite make a lot of sense, but that you have to maybe see every Christmas. Because, I mean, that's the best we can hope for, right, is that we treat ourselves as well as maybe we treat other people. We speak as well in our head about ourselves as we do out loud about other people. And I say in my book, I think I'm about 15% there.
But you also write, you consider your face the perfect canvas to be other people.
Yes, I was told once that I had a great face for wigs, which is almost the title of this book. And I take as a huge compliment because I like that I look different with different hair. And I loved being a sketch performer and trying on all these looks and everyone being like, oh, you could be a brunette. Oh, no, you could do that. Oh, you could cut your hair short. Oh, wow. You should definitely do it. And it certainly allowed me, or I felt emboldened by the fact that playing other people and being in charge of how I looked and the characters I got to play helped me escape what was sometimes a disappointing face in my mind's eye.
When you tell a great story, when you were working in improv in Chicago very early in your career, you briefly dated a male model who was in your improv class. And you write, it's the first time you dated someone that handsome, but the truth was he was in your improv class and wasn't that funny, so you felt weirdly superior. And then you made the mistake of snooping and reading his journal, and you found an entry that said he was proud of himself for dating someone like you and that you were funny but not that pretty, which was kind of cool, and he wasn't that into you, but he was totally down for the journey. So what effect did it have on you to read his journal evaluating your look and not scoring you that high?
Well, it just goes to show that you should never read anyone's journal. You're never going to find anything good in there. But I was a world-class snooper and still am, unfortunately, which is why I need to stay away from the internet because it's no good for me. But
I'm rescinding the dinner invitation to my house.
Yeah, I will rifle through your things, Terry. But it was twofold. It was like a strange relief, which was, aha, I knew that you didn't think I was pretty. And then it was followed by a real, like, crash because just my ego was bruised. But what it taught me or what I took out of it or hoped that I took out of it was this idea that figuring out your currency is important. And the earlier you do, the happier you are. And I learned or decided early on that my looks were not going to be what I leaned on. And once I decided that, then it was a little freeing, not only for my work, because vanity is a tough thing to have in comedy, but also just I didn't care as much about if people thought I was pretty or not pretty.
So, Amy Poehler, why do you think it's okay to read other people's journals and snoop through their stuff?
I don't think it's
appalling behavior.
I know it's terrible. It's not appropriate to look through people's stuff. Terry, I will agree with you that it's terrible behavior. But I'm also going to say that I can't help myself most of the time. I always liked to know where I stood. I'm a person that would much rather know what you think about me than live in some blissful state of denial. That being said, it's not good to read people's journals. That being said, I will read your journal if you leave it near me. So what can I tell you?
this reminds me when I interviewed John Le Carré, he was talking about, he used to be a spy and then became a writer of spy fiction. And he said, writers are spies and they will go through your medicine cabinet. see what's in it.
Yeah. I mean, I used to, when I would think of characters for SNL, I used to sit on the subway and just sit next to people and write down what they were saying and eavesdrop constantly and try to get some small little specifics that would help me change something from a caricature to an actual character. Yeah, I was always observing and listening and stealing.
Can you think of an example in a sketch where a line that you came up with was something that you overheard and had written down and therefore remembered?
Well, I used to do this kind of hyperactive, energetic girl on SNL called Caitlin, who was kind of a latchkey kid, and the scene was an homage to the Judy Miller show that Gilda used to do, and me and Emily Spivey, a writer in SNL, would write that. And I would go and listen to young girls tell stories, like at parks and stuff. And they always do that thing where they like they're like, and one time, like they always say one time. And one time I did this, and like one time, like, and I loved that that sense, like, you know, they spoke as if they had a lifetime of experiences and they were like nine. And so that kind of stuff, maybe I would glean from real people.
Tina Fey got on Saturday Night Live before you did, and you say that she helped you get on. You were there at what seemed like it was a really good time for you and for women in general. During part of the time you were there, Tina Fey was the head writer. When she left, Seth Meyers became the head writer, and I don't think he's going to win any contest for the most misogynist man in the world.
No, oh God, he's a mush. He's
right.
A,
no, he seems like yeah. such a swell person.
He's the best.
And there were other really strong women in the cast. So did you think of it as like a really good time to be a woman on Saturday Night Live?
Yes, I think I was aware that I had dropped in at a really special time. I mean, the women were so powerful and talented and in control of the show in many ways. And, you know, Molly Shannon and Anna Gasteyer and Sherry O'Terry were kind of on their way out. And Maya Rudolph and Rachel Dratch and Kristen Wiig and Tina and everybody was – the talent was really intense. And I think Lorne Michaels has done more for women in comedy than anyone I know. So I knew that Lorne was a supporter and lover of women in comedy, but I also knew that that show had gone through different captains with different experiences, and everybody had very subjective experiences when they were there. So I did not take for granted that I was there during a good time. But I happened to start SNL at a time when, you know, people were saying that comedy was dead, and that wasn't so fun. My first show was 2 weeks after September 11th. And, you know, it was that time when people were saying, like, will we ever laugh again? And I remember thinking, well, could we try to laugh for like a year and see how we feel?
So I want to get back to your work with Tina Fey for a second and say I'm so glad you found ways to continue to work together, which leads us to a clip I want to play of the two of you the first time you hosted the Golden Globe Awards, and that was in 2013. And so here's a clip of your opening together, and the first person we'll hear is you.
It was a great year for film. Women in film, Kathryn Bigelow nominated tonight. I haven't really been following the controversy over Zero Dark Thirty, but when it comes to torture, I trust the lady who spent 3 years married to James Cameron.
Of course, we want to thank our hosts tonight, the HFPA, for having us. Amy, tell the people a little bit about the HFPA.
Yes, Tina. Well, when left untreated, HFPA can lead to cervical cancer. However, there is a vaccination.
Oh, no, that's Amy. That's HPV.
Oh, I'm sorry. Of course. The HFPA is the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. And when left untreated,
no,
they can go...
Oh. She's kidding. There is no known cure for the Hollywood Foreign Press.
My guests, Amy Poehler and Tina Fey at the 2013 Golden Globes when they were hosting. That's hysterical, and you got such big laughs. My gosh. So how do you and Tina Fey work out who gets which lines in a setting like that?
Well, we write jokes together. We treat it like Update. And then we kind of divide. And it's funny, you know, Tina and I are so used to working together, we kind of know who will deliver something better. But sometimes we both want the same joke because we know it's a good one. And so it just kind of figures itself out. They, you know, we just have to kind of be democratic about it. It just kind of happens.
When you left Saturday Night Live, you were going into labor, and that was your last edition, because after that you were going to start the new show, Parks and Recreation. And you write about in your memoir that the day before you went into labor, your obstetrician died of a heart attack, and you just kind of panicked, like, who was going to deliver your baby? This doctor who'd gotten to know you wasn't going to be there. You were rehearsing the next edition of Saturday Night Live with John Hamm hosting, and you say he grabbed you by the shoulders because you were just kind of panicking. And he said, this is a very important show for me, and I need you to pull yourself together. Was he being funny or serious?
Oh, he was being funny. I was crying. because my OBGYN had just passed away and he was a lovely man. And I was in a real panic. And I was so pregnant. And a really, really pregnant woman crying is terrifying. So I was like sobbing. And I just was getting to know John. We're now very good friends. But at the time, I didn't know him that well. And he just kind of came to me and he was like, I need you to pull together. This is a big deal for me. And it made me laugh so hard that I think going from laughing to crying to laughing to crying, making those quick turns, adds years to your life. And it's what's really fun about doing comedy is you can just be in the saddest place and somebody can say something and just it switches you and makes you laugh. And so I loved it. You know, he read the room. He read me right. And it was exactly what I needed to hear. And I remember shooting this whole Mad Men parody and then rehearsing all day and then going in the afternoon to the new doctor, a wonderful man who took over this doctor's patients. And, you know, he was grieving because he had lost his partner and he kind of checked me and he was like, well, nothing's dilated. You're looking good. And I was like, okay, well, I have a show tomorrow and then I'm hoping to deliver the baby on Sunday. And, you know, then I'll have the week, you know, just like that ridiculous thing where you think you're in control of birth and death. And then I sat on the main stage at SNL and watched my castmates doing all these really funny bits where they were pretending they were at their own funerals. And I was just laughing and just completely blissfully in the moment. And then I went home and turned on Law and Order and was lying next to my then-husband, Will, and the sound of the bump-bump came on TV and my water broke. And I was like, oh, no, but I have a show tonight. And so that's when my oldest, Archie, was born.
So you were in the hospital watching sketches that you'd rehearsed, but you couldn't be in because you were in labor.
Yeah.
So what was that feeling like?
It was wild. It was like being in the past and the present and the future all at the same time. I mean, it was such an out-of-body experience, giving birth and then holding my son and then watching on TV, you know, people saying, we love you, Amy. Like, you know, get that baby out. And I was just, it was amazing. It was beautiful. And I was so lucky to be able to do all of that stuff while I was pregnant. It was so fun.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Amy Poehler, and she's the star of Parks and Recreation, which will soon be starting its seventh and final season. And, of course, she's an alumna of Saturday Night Live. Now she has a new memoir, which is called Yes, Please. Let's hear a clip from Parks and Recreation. And this is a kind of famous episode because you meet Joe Biden in it. The real Joe Biden is in it. And you've always had this kind of celebrity crush on him, your character has. And your character has often said that your ideal man has the brains of George Clooney and the body of Joe Biden. And so in this episode from season 5, your fiancé, Ben Wyatt, who's played by Adam Scott, calls in a favor in Washington and surprises you with a special engagement present, which is a chance to meet the vice president. And in this scene, we're not going to be able to see this part, but in this scene, you hold Biden's hand, you touch his face, and at one point you even try to move in for a kiss. And at the end of the scene, you speak kind of sharply to a Secret Service agent. But let's start where you and Ben walk into the large room and you are surprised to see Joe Biden there talking to his aides.
How did you do this?
Call in a few favors.
Excuse me, sir.
A few hundred favors. Mr. Vice President, Ben Wyatt from Congressman Murray's office.
Hey, Ben, Dave told me you were going to be coming by, and you must be Leslie Knope. Welcome. Welcome.
My name just came out of your mouth.
Well, yeah, it did.
Well, this isn't happening. This isn't real.
No, it's happening, and I'm delighted to have you here. On behalf of the president and myself,
Vice President, I am deeply flattered, but there's no way that I could take over Madam Secretary Clinton's position. I mean,
I'm confident you could do that job or any other, but
okay, I will.
Well, the reason you're here is, I'm told, you've done such a great job in your town and in the state of Indiana, and I just want to say congratulations for your public service.
And I just want to say thank you.
Well, you're very welcome. You're very welcome. Okay. You're very welcome.
You're very handsome.
I think we're all done.
Well, you're very nice.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We'll see you tomorrow.
Well, you will?
Thank you, Mr. Vice President.
You're welcome.
You don't let anything happen to him. Do you understand me? He is precious cargo.
That's you speaking to the Secret Service agent at the end. So did you rehearse with Biden before this? How did you get him to do it?
No, you know, and just hearing that again, Vice President Biden is so great. I mean, he's really funny in that scene. I don't know if you can tell, but he's kind of like being nice, but also slowly pushing me away from him. That was an example of, you know, I think we probably had a half an hour to shoot that. And we sent them the idea. And then when we got there, we just kind of improvised. I think I was improvising most of that stuff. Sometimes when you have a short amount of time, the energy can be helpful for a scene instead of thinking it over. So thank him and his people. You know, we met briefly and we talked and then we kind of shot it and then he left to do more important things. But it was really fun, and he was very game, you know. That would be like a good improv partner because he was playing the reality of the scene and not breaking character and, you know, just letting me be crazy around him. It was a lot of fun.
I'm surprised to hear that you improvised some of that scene only because I would think that the White House would want such control over what happened.
Yes. We sent them the scene, and then I just improvised. And I improvised, like, my name came out of your mouth, and you're very handsome, you know. And I leaned in for a kiss because, you know, you got to go for it. But I think, you know, I've learned that it's not always smart to ask before you do something. Just kind of do it.
Did you learn that on Saturday Night Live?
I did, yeah. You kind of got used to figuring out what you should go approach people about. You know, for example, when we were doing the Golden Globes, there was a bit where I wanted to sit on George Clooney's lap when my name was being announced in the hopes that if I won, I would kiss him like he was my husband. And I knew from my years of working both sides of being on camera and behind the camera that it was better to ask George Clooney's people, would you mind if Amy sat next to George when her name was announced? And of course they would say no, and they would ask him or not ask him, and they would say no. And it's just too much to be like, can she sit on his lap? And then I just got to the table and I was like, can I sit on your lap? And he was like, sure. So it's a little bit easier to just ask in person.
And a little harder to say no in person.
Yep. It's a little harder to say no in person. That's what any knife salesman will tell you. Any door-to-door knife salesman will tell you that.
Amy Poehler, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure, Terry. I love you and your show. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's so great to have you back on the show. Thank you so much. And good luck with the final season of Parks and Recreation.
Thank you so very much. Have a great day. And thanks again.
Amy Poehler spoke with Terry last Tuesday. Poehler's new memoir is called Yes, Please. Olive Kitteridge, the new two-part, four-hour HBO miniseries, sounds like the kind of long-form drama TV used to make back in the 70s and 80s when miniseries ruled. Like them, Olive Kitteridge covers an entire generation in the lives of its characters, a 25-year span. But otherwise, it couldn't be more different. Most of those sprawling classic miniseries were set against major historical events and were as much about passionate romance and glamorous costumes as anything else. Olive Kitteridge, which stars Frances McDormand as a fiercely acerbic New England teacher, wife, and mother, is just the opposite. It's all about family and friends and the tenuous relationships that make up life. There's no glamour whatsoever in Olive Kitteridge, unless you count a wedding ceremony or two. But even those are layered not with pomp and circumstance, but with the tiniest, most revealing bits of human behavior. Olive Kitteridge comes from an interrelated collection of stories by Elizabeth Strout about the residents of a small town in Maine. It's centered mostly around the title character, played by Frances McDormand, who so strongly responded to these stories and this character that she optioned it from the author the week before the book won a Pulitzer Prize. Great timing. Adapting the stories for television was a tough act to pull off. But star and executive producer McDormand, with her chosen on-screen and off-screen collaborators, does it superbly. The director is Lisa Cholodenko, who demonstrated her ability to film intimate family dynamics in The Kids Are All Right and Laurel Canyon. The screenplay adaptation is by Jane Anderson, who wrote Normal. Playing opposite McDormand in the equally crucial role of Olive's husband, Henry, is Richard Jenkins from 6 Feet Under. And the supporting cast, giving great support every step of the way, is truly top-notch, including a late but pivotal appearance by Bill Murray. Olive Kitteridge tells most of its story in a series of flashbacks. We first get to know the central family when Olive is a public school math teacher, Henry is a pharmacist, and they have a young son, Christopher. At the dinner table, tensions are high. Henry is infatuated with one of his young employees at work. Olive is dismissive of both the girl and of Henry. And as the son, Christopher, listens to his parents discuss a neighbor with mental health issues, Olive doesn't exactly ease the already palpable dinner conversation tension.
Rachel Colson has depression. Do you know what that is?
No, not really.
You should. It runs in our family.
No, it doesn't.
Henry, you nuts? What do you think was going on with my father?
That was a different thing.
No, it wasn't. Your mother had it, too.
Well, not the same. I mean, she had her moods, but...
She was clinical, Henry.
What's depression?
It's bad wiring. Makes your nerves raw.
Is that why you're so mean all the time?
Absolutely.
Your mother is not depressed.
Yes, I am. Happy to have it, because it's being smart.
All right, Ollie.
Well, we might as well discuss it, Henry. He might have it, too.
But you don't think I'm smart.
Of course I do.
No, you don't. You think I'm average.
You are plenty complicated, Christopher.
This miniseries also is plenty complicated. Like The Affair, currently running on Showtime, Olive Kitteridge sometimes returns to the same scene with a slightly different perspective. But most of the time, it relies on its actors to convey all that's unsaid but implied, and they do it beautifully. As Henry, Jenkins at times almost oozes with longing and unrequited love. Then, at other times, surprises you with his humor and self-assurance. And as for Olive, well, without an actress as strong and talented as McDormand, this miniseries simply would fall apart. It's as powerful a performance and as challenging and complicated as when Claire Danes starred in HBO's Temple Grandin. If you don't care for Olive, even at her most abrasive and disconnected, then nothing works. But everything in Olive Kitteridge works just fine. There's one scene in which Olive is shown accidentally overhearing some other characters discussing what they really think of her. And not just her personality, but her style of dress, her relationship with her son, everything. McDormand doesn't have a line of dialogue in that scene. She just listens. But she reveals such quiet devastation that you're with her from then on. Olive Kitteridge allows its characters to age and their relationships to change. And it also allows some of those characters and those relationships to die, which somehow, by the end, makes you appreciate the small miracle of survival all the more. By focusing on the little things over a long period of time, Olive Kitteridge reminds us that the little things add up, in the end, to the biggest things of all. Coming up, The Secret History of Wonder Woman. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. The most popular female comic book hero of all time has a secret past, one that is revealed in the new book, The Secret History of Wonder Woman, by our next guest, Jill Lepore. The creator of Wonder Woman, William Moulton Marston, led a secret life with his wife and his mistress. He fathered children with each of them, and they all lived together. His vision for Wonder Woman reflected his interest in the women's suffrage movement and in Margaret Sanger, the birth control and women's rights activist, who happened to be his mistress's aunt. Wonder Woman's costume was inspired by his interest in erotic pinup art. Jill Lepore was first intrigued by Wonder Woman's history when she found the Marston-Sanger connection while researching two seemingly unrelated subjects. A legal story involving the lie detector, which was invented by Marston before he created Wonder Woman, and a history of Planned Parenthood, which focused on its founder, Margaret Sanger. Lepore is a staff writer for The New Yorker and a professor of American history at Harvard. She spoke with Terry last Monday.
Jill Lepore, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let me just start with a really obvious question. For people who have never read Wonder Woman and just know her more as a metaphor, just describe Wonder Woman, the superhero character.
Thanks for having me. It's fun being here. Wonder Woman is an Amazon from an island of women who left ancient Greece to escape the enslavement of men. They lived on Paradise Island and had eternal life, and a plane crashes on their island carrying a man, and Wonder Woman's mother decides he needs to be brought back to where he came from because they can have no men on Paradise Island. So she stitches for Wonder Woman this star-spangled costume, and Wonder Woman flies in her invisible jet with her man captive, Steve Trevor, who's a U.S. military intelligence officer, back to the United States. This is in 1941, and comes to call herself Wonder Woman because she has superhuman powers that only Amazons have. She has bracelets that can stop bullets. She has a magic lasso, a golden lasso. Anyone she ropes has to tell the truth. And then she's got the cool jet.
So it is just amazing to me that this character is inspired in part by Margaret Sanger and the suffragists, and Margaret Sanger being the mother of the birth control movement, the person who came up with the term birth control. So how did the creator, William Moulton Marston, come to care first about the suffragists?
So it turns out Marston has all kinds of ties to the early progressive era suffrage and feminist and birth control movements. His ties really begin when he, as a Harvard freshman in 1911, is caught up in a big controversy on campus. In the fall of 1911, the Harvard Men's League for Women's Suffrage invites the incredible Emmeline Pankhurst to campus to speak in Sanders Theater, which is like the largest lecture hall on campus. And the Harvard Corporation is terrified. Women are not allowed to speak on campus, and they've made one exception in the past. And they say they're never going to make an exception for Emmeline Pankhurst, who is scary in the sense that she and her followers in England have been doing things like chaining themselves to the gates outside 10 Downing Street and getting arrested. They believe really that the fight for suffrage has been so many decades and gotten nowhere that any means necessary are at this point allowed. So Pankhurst is banned from speaking on campus. And this is a kind of a big fracas across the country because people like to take pot shots at Harvard, of course. But also it's kind of hilarious that Harvard is so terrified of this tiny little woman, Emmeline Pankhurst. They prevent her from speaking on campus. And so she speaks off campus in this kind of dance hall on Brattle Street in Harvard Square. And even to that alone, there's so much in there that reappears in Wonder Woman 30 years later when Marston creates Wonder Woman in 1941. One of the things that's a defining element of Wonder Woman is that if a man binds her in chains, she loses all of her Amazonian strength. And so in almost every episode of the early comics, the ones that Marston wrote, she's chained up or she's roped up. It's usually chains. And then she has to break free of these chains. And that's Marston would always say, in order to signify her emancipation from men. But those chains are a really important part of the feminist and suffrage struggles of the 1910s that Marston had a kind of front row seat for.
We should acknowledge, and we'll get into this in more detail later, there's a big kind of fetishistic sexual aspect to the bondage and the chains in Wonder Woman. We'll get to that a little later. So
that's just a little teaser, Terry.
That's
right
just
there.
A little teaser, yeah.
Stay tuned. The bondage is coming up.
But this next thing is good enough to hold us over for a while. And, I mean, one of the really amazing things you've uncovered in your book is that the creator of Wonder Woman, William Moulton Marston, lived in a menage a trois eventually, but earlier in his life there were two women he was with. There was his wife, Sadie Elizabeth Holloway, and another woman, Olive Byrne. And Olive Byrne was Margaret Sanger's niece. And so they were in a relationship together. He had four children by those two women. And of course, they couldn't make it public. But describe a little bit this arrangement that he had first with these two women.
So Marston married his childhood sweetheart in 1915 when they both graduated from college. He graduated from Harvard that year, and she graduated from Mount Holyoke. This is Sadie Elizabeth Holloway, who becomes Betty Marston. And she was quite an interesting and ambitious woman, a really career-oriented woman of that generation, of, you know, one of the first generations of women to go to college. And Marston first teaches at American University, and then in something of a scandal, he loses that job, and he ends up teaching at Tufts in 1925, where he falls in love with one of his students, who's a senior there, Olive Byrne. Olive Byrne's mother is Ethel Byrne, who is the sister of Margaret Sanger. Ethel Byrne and Margaret Sanger together founded what becomes Planned Parenthood in 1916 when they opened the first birth control clinic in the United States in Brooklyn. Olive Byrne falls in love with Marston when he's teaching at Tufts for a year, and he at that point has developed some pretty unconventional ideas about sex and gender that come from his work as a psychologist and from other kinds of proclivities that I think are unreachable to the historian. So he says to his wife, you know, I've met somebody, and here's the deal. Either she can come live with us and we will live as a threesome, or I will leave you for her. And Holloway, who now is this woman with a law degree and a master's degree, and she's working in Washington at that time, she really wants to have a family. And she decides, okay, this deal will work for me because I will keep my job and she's going to raise my children. She can be your mistress, but she will raise my children. And so they decide to live together as a threesome.
So here they are, this unconventional family with this huge secret. But Marston is the inventor of the lie detector test and bills himself as somebody who cannot be deceived, you know, because he can find out the truth through this, you know, machine that he invented. And that's just so bizarre.
Yeah, it's so bizarre. I think they thought it was very funny. And in a certain way, it is very funny, like that they're putting one over on everybody. So the funniest thing of it all to me, so this really triangular family arrangement, right? But in the 30s, Olive Byrne takes a job as a staff writer for Family Circle magazine, writing advice for housewives. Like Family Circle starts in 1932. It's a giveaway at the grocery store. And the stories that she writes are sort of how to raise your children in the most conventional possible way. It's hilariously bizarre.
Let's talk about how Marston came to create Wonder Woman. You know, he starts off in the entertainment industry by working in Hollywood for a while as a psychologist and consultant. And how does he get involved in the comic book world?
Yeah, so he's blacklisted from academia because of his family arrangements, which are kind of found out. He goes to Hollywood. That's fun. It doesn't quite work out. He comes back to New York and really scrambles in the 1930s, doesn't have much of a way to support himself. He becomes a very popular kind of pop psych writer. He writes for all kinds of magazines. But comic books start in 1933, 34, and then the first superhero, Superman, starts in 1938. Batman follows in 1939. But then immediately there's a pretty big crisis around comic books. People think they're bad for kids and that Superman's a fascist. And so the guy who publishes Superman, M.C. Gaines, decides he wants to hire someone to help him out. And he reads an article by Olive Byrne in Family Circle about how William Moulton Marston thinks comic books might be good for kids. And so he calls Marston into his office.
And Marston thinks what you really need is a woman superhero. Why does he think that?
Well, if you think about the problems with the comic books, Marston says it's their blood-curdling masculinity that's the problem. That they're just too violent. It's really the violence, but it's also the domination. Right? So the reason Superman looks like a fascist to some literary critics is he's kind of a demagogue, but also he overpowers everybody. And this is, you know, in the shadow of what's going on in Europe, it's very terrifying to imagine kids sort of worshiping this ubermensch. And so he says, look, if you had a female superhero, her powers could all be about love and truth and beauty. And you could also sell your comic books better to girls. And that would be really important and great because she could show girls that they could do anything.
So he gets the green light and he suggests that she be visually modeled on the Varger girls. And the Varger girls are They're pinups. They're illustrations of very scantily clad young women in very seductive poses, which is so interesting because his conception is of this, like, empowered woman, but the way she looks is for the sexual arousal of men.
Yeah. There's no simple story here. There are a lot of people that I think get very upset at what Marston was doing, and people who got upset at the time for reasons that people get upset thinking about what he's doing now. Like, wait, is this a feminist project that's supposed to help girls decide to go to college and have careers, or is this just like soft porn? You know, it actually, that was the question in the 1940s too.
But her image, Wonder Woman's image, was also influenced by photos and illustrations of suffragists.
Yeah, and that's the piece that's missing. And that's the part that I really wanted to pay attention to and try to recover. Because you can look at Wonder Woman from the 1940s and you can see, it's immediately apparent to you, the fetishism, right? You can also immediately see the feminism, that when Wonder Woman is out in those early stories that Marston wrote, she's doing things like organizing working women to go on strike for equal pay with men. She's running for president. I mean, they're really very overtly feminist stories. But then there's the where she's always being chained up and she's gagged. And so it was important for me to think about where that came from. And Harry G. Peter, who's the artist who Marston hired, specifically hired to draw Wonder Woman, and really had not been involved in comics and wasn't particularly a good comics illustrator, had known this woman, Annie Lucasta Rogers. They were together staff artists at Judge Magazine in the 19-teens, where they both worked on the suffrage page, where they do cartoons, editorial cartoons featuring suffragists. And one of the things that Lou Rogers always did was draw this sort of allegorical, iconic, Amazonian-like woman breaking chains.
So Wonder Woman is this mix, as we've been saying, of kind of fetishistic pinup girl imagery and suffragism and feminism. And as you pointed out, in most of her adventures, she's bound up in chains and has to liberate herself, has to free herself. So that kind of has two associations. One is that, like a lot of the feminists, the suffragists used to chain themselves in protest and use chains as a symbol of their bondage. At the same time, there's a lot of fetishism in that too, I think, in the way that Wonder Woman is often bound up. So can you talk about that kind of like double level that the bondage is working on?
Yeah, it became really controversial in the 1940s. Wonder Woman was banned, partly because she was so scantily dressed. But members of the editorial advisory board that what became DC Comics had put together resigned in protest over Wonder Woman and the bondage. Because guys like soldiers, this is a really fascinating letter from a GI stationed, I don't know, maybe somewhere in Texas, who writes to say, like, I just love these Wonder Woman comics. I mean, I just, the chains and the heels, those boots. You know, you're just like, reading the letter. And, you know, Gaines forwards this letter to Marston. Marston says, hey, I think that's great. I think that's, well, look, you know, it's completely harmless. Like, I'm a psychologist. I have a PhD from Harvard. I will assure you, this is completely harmless. I think all the more power to it. Like, well, unless someone's hurting someone, what anything goes. Which has actually been Marston's big principle. This book that he writes in 1928, Emotions of Normal People, is all about, you know what, don't think about your sexual behavior as abnormal. And it's actually this incredibly moving thing to read. I mean, he's really opposed to prejudice against nonconformists.
So Wonder Woman was the first woman in the League of Justice, or the Justice Society of America, this first collection of superheroes. But in the League of Justice, she was the secretary.
Yeah, doesn't that stink? Doesn't that just rile you?
Yeah. So what's the difference between how Wonder Woman is written and drawn in the Justice Society of America comics and the way she's drawn and written in the Wonder Woman comics, where it's Marston who's overseeing it?
Yeah, so she does nothing in the Justice Society comics. She sort of just looks beautiful. And she sounds like they'll be at Justice Society headquarters and all the guys will be there. And there's like some message comes in and they need to go fly off and, you know, save Europe or something. And Wonder Woman says, oh, I haven't yet typed up last week's meeting minutes, so I'll have to stay behind. But good luck, boys. It's just maddening. It's just so funny. But the reason that's important is think about how different what Marston was doing then really actually was. Because those Justice Society stories are swimming along with the current of the culture, right? Everything is like that for the 1940s, right? But Marston's out there, he's swimming upstream the other way. Because he writes, he finally just has a fit. And he says, no, I'm going to write a Justice Society story. And then he writes one. And it's really weird. But Wonder Woman does actually fly in a rocket out into outer space to do something, you know, which is... It's a measure of the difference between Marston's sense of what women could or could not do and the rest of the culture's sense of that.
Because William Marston really believed in women's rights, and the suffrage movement was kind of formative for him. But, you know, at home he has basically two wives, a wife and a mistress. He has children with both of them. And I keep asking myself, was he being very sexist at home by having, like, two wives, basically? Or was this a good arrangement for the two women, and that, you know, his wife was able to have a career and have the mistress, you know, raise the children? What did the women think of it? Did they see it as empowering or as, you know, a man domineering their lives and them not each having a husband to themselves? I have a feeling you can't answer those questions, but just thinking about it is so interesting. I wish we could answer those questions.
Yeah. No, I do too. But I have two things to say. One is that when Holloway does write these letters in 1963 saying what it was like.
This is the wife.
She says, look, you know, we both loved him and he loved us. And there was lovemaking for all. That's the phrase she uses. And the kids all say it was actually a delightful way to grow up, that they were deeply loved by everybody in different ways. So I actually think that it would be better really to turn the camera. Like, if we have a telescope and we're trying to look through the window of their bedroom, right? It would be better to take that telescope, zoom back out, and look at the larger culture and say, look, why do people still joke? I'm sure you have friends, heterosexual couples who are both working and raising kids, who say, geez, you know what we need a wife, you know, to stay home and take care of the kids. But that is actually still remains a problem, that the basic structural problems that are attendant on thinking about women as political actors and women as economic actors on a stage of equality with men have never yet been solved. And they have actually been barely addressed. That in fact, they're put to one side by each generation. And there are all these crazy patches that are patched all on top of these problems. And so I love the family story. I think it's fascinating, it's dramatic and interesting. But I hope that what it causes people to reflect on is the duration and the stubbornness and the lack of advance in this struggle for women's equality.
Jill Lepore, thank you for talking with us, and thank you for writing this really interesting book.
Thanks, it was a lot of fun.
Jill Lepore is the author of The Secret History of Wonder Woman. She spoke with Terry last Monday. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.